Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your solo host today, Monica Hadley. And our guest today, Heather Webb, is a USA Today best-selling and award-winning author of historical fiction, including her latest, The Next Ship Home and Strangers in the Night. In 2015, Rodin's Lover was a Goodreads top pick, and in 2018, Last Christmas in Paris won the Women's Fiction Writers Association Star Award, and Meet Me in Monaco was also an award-winning book. To date, Heather's books have been translated into 17 languages. Now, Heather is a teacher at heart, so after obtaining her Bachelor of Arts degree in French and Education and a Master of Science in Cultural Geography, she taught high school for nearly a decade. Currently, she's a freelance editor and works as an adjunct for the MFA in Creative Writing Program at Drexel University in Philadelphia. She lives in New England with her family, a mischievous kitten, and one feisty rabbit. And the book that we're talking about today is Queens of London. Welcome to Writer's Voices, Heather.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how many books have you written and published so far?
So this is my 10th, or I guess you could say, my 9th, but my 10th, I'm about to turn in. It's a collaboration, the next book down the road. Somewhere between 9 and 10.
Somewhere between 9 and 10. And they're all historical?
They're all historical fiction.
Historical fiction. And you mentioned a collaborator. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Sure. So I do write solo novels in a range from biographical historicals to, fictional characters in a real setting. But then I also on occasion collaborate with Hazel Gaynor, who is an English author. She also writes historical fiction. We're working on our fourth book. That's what's due March 15th. So we are sort of feverishly editing at the moment. The books I write with Hazel tend to be a little bit more romantic. They're still historical fiction, very heavily researched and all that good stuff. But my solo novels tend to be a little bit grittier, a little bit more book club fiction centered kind of thing. So
you mentioned in there biographical novels, and then I can't remember what you referred to the other type, but tell us what the distinction between those two are.
Sure. So historical fiction, really, it's kind of just a label that says, okay, this story took place in the past. And there's a million. So every, genre of fiction out there could technically be historical if it's set in the past. So, it's just a huge range. And so I write somewhat in that range because I like to challenge myself as a writer. I like to grow. I like to try new things for fun as well, mix it up a bit. So I do have a few biographical historicals, and those are novels that are very heavily researched and based on true-to-life people who lived in the past. And then I've also written books where there is a real event, a true event in history, but the characters that move through that landscape are fictional. That's actually my favorite. It's my favorite kind to write because there's a lot more freedom to move within that, framework. And there's all variations between.
Now, Queens of London, even though you say it's not a biographical novel, parts of it are.
It's kind of both. It's a bit of a mashup. Yes, because there are two true-to-life people. One is Diamond Annie, who is the leader of the 40 Elephants Gang, and that's the very first all-female crime syndicate. So she's the leader of the pack. She was a real person. And the other real person in the story is Lillian Wiles, who was the first female admitted to the Criminal Investigation Department at Scotland Yard. But I also have two other main characters that are fictional. I have an underestimated shop clerk, and I have a 10-year-old half-Indian little girl who is on the run.
But all of those characters, really, you write from all their points of view at different times in the book.
Yes.
Was that hard to be switching around like that?
Well, there's a challenge with every book, and this was definitely challenging. I think that, I said something in my author's note about how, as I began writing this, the story played behind my eyes like a movie reel, and it really did. So the drafting, the first half of the book was fairly straightforward. I just kind of intuitively switched points of view as I needed to tell a different part of the story. But then I got somewhere halfway through it and got kind of lost and went, okay, I need to look at each of these characters' arcs and see how they're changing, if I'm going in the right direction, how many scenes each character has. So I made a giant storyboard for my office wall and taped it up there. And I took different colored sticky notes and did, you know, all of Alice in hot pink and all of Hera in bright yellow and so on, you know, for all four of them, and just put a little bullet point about what the scene is that they were in, you know, and it really helped me see clearly what was happening and what needed to come next. And then the same thing kind of happened in the editing process. I got lost because that's just a lot of people and a lot of scenes to kind of work through. So for the first time ever, I used a program called Scrivener, which many writers are familiar with. Mm-hmm. Dabble and YWriter are two other programs that work similarly to Scrivener. But it allows you to manipulate the scenes and the chapters very easily. You can move things around. You can color code. It has this giant cork board with note cards, all kinds of cool techniques and tips that you can use to help. And it really helped me in the editing process, for sure. Well, I can see things more clearly.
Yeah. So yeah. You actually in your editing, you move things. It doesn't necessarily end up in the same order that you wrote them in.
A little bit. So for this book, because there were so many perspectives, I needed to make sure the right scene happened at the right time. Or I would say, okay, I need to add an entire new scene about XYZ in Lillian's point of view that's not here. So I'd have to comb through the chapters and figure out where that would be. Well, in Scrivener, each chapter is a folder. So it's very simple. It's labeled. It's very simple to see where I would, you know, create that new folder, that new scene, that new chapter.
So do you think you'll continue using that tool?
I'm kind of in love with it now. It's so easy to use. I don't use all the bells and whistles. It's a very powerful program. I just use the very basics. I actually started my current work in progress on Microsoft Word and was having trouble moving forward. I had about 10,000 words and I was sort of stewing over it and angsty and everything else. You know how we go through those phases. So I uploaded it to Scrivener to see, you know, maybe I'll just write down scenes that come to me, which is very strange because I'm a linear writer usually. But as soon as I started doing that, I realized, oh my gosh, this is a dual timeline novel. That's why I'm having trouble moving forward. And I didn't know it until I went to Scrivener and started just writing scenes that came to mind. And again, because you can move them around so easily, it was so incredibly helpful. So suddenly I'm making forward motion again, which is good.
So are the commands similar to Word, so it's an easy transition to go from Word to that?
They're not. The good news is there are a lot of tutorials on YouTube, short ones that are very easy to follow. I mean, you could really get into the weeds with all of the different tools that it has, but I don't spend too much time learning all that stuff. I just kind of learned the basics.
Is there anything you can't learn on YouTube these days?
There's not much.
Man, I mean, everything from like when I had trouble with the water filter in my refrigerator, you go to YouTube and find out exactly what you have to do to fix it. It's like,
it's really
amazing.
The best how-to site out there. It really is.
It sure is. You know, it's, you talked about historical fiction being a label, basically, that says the story is set on the in the past, which is now like my lifetime. It is now historical fiction.
Yes. And somewhat in mine, too.
Yeah.
I try not to be offended by that. But
I know. It's like, oh, come on. The 70s isn't it? Yeah, I guess it is history by now.
Yeah.
So when you're looking for your next project, how do you decide? You know, the history is such a broad task. Is there some common, or such a broad area, is there some common theme of the subjects that you've written about that drew you to them?
You know, I don't set out to do common themes, but I end up circling them anyway. I think a lot of writers do that. It's just, you know, it's related to our past experiences and the things we're drawn to in terms of topics. But when I'm thinking about something new, I usually, I will have had an idea folder that, you know, when I've come across a new idea that I've saved. And it's this really strange thing that's hard to describe, but there's a bit of an instinct involved. You know, I might have five ideas on a back burner that aren't particularly well developed, but usually one presents itself to me when the time is right. For example, I knew I wanted to write a book about Ellis Island, and about the immigrant experience in America and what it means to be American around the turn of the 20th century in New York City. And so I had been thinking about that book for several years, but I just knew I wasn't ready for it. And it's instinct. And then suddenly when in 2020, but the one before that, 2016, when that whole election cycle started, I was again thinking about what it means to be American. And I thought, you know, it's time for me to write this book. And I just kept thinking about it. Articles kept popping up about immigration. And I said, yep, I'm going in. I'm doing it. So I pulled that idea out of the folder and I started research and became obsessed. And that book is The Next Ship Home. Which has been great. And it's been a book club favorite, which I love, of course. That makes me really happy. So a lot of it is instinctive. I think as I was almost finished with The Next Ship Home, I wanted a book that looked at the class system again, because you get a bit of that with the immigrant experience. So I wanted to look more at the class system. I wanted to look at roles women played in the early 20th century and a bit about the women's rights movement. And all of that happens in Queens of London.
Right.
So you can see that there's a connection. And if you look across all of my novels, I tend to write about people that break rules, that are bold, that aren't necessarily the most likable, perfect human beings. They're messy human beings, but they're always on some level sympathetic. Because I really try to get at the humanity of a character, even if they aren't incredibly likable, so to speak.
I found it interesting in your author notes where you talk about one of the kind of lesser characters, but Simon, and how he is a very, you know, seems like a really, really decent guy, and probably one of the few decent men that Diamond Annie knows in her life, that he popped up in one mention in your research. And what did it say about him?
You know, I think it said something along the lines of, it actually came from a book about Alice Diamond and the 40 Elephants, which was written by Brian McDonald. He's a gangland expert, a UK gangland expert. And he actually said there was mention of a potential romance with a man named Simon in some article that he had found. And that was it. I mean, it was one line in his book. And I thought, ooh, that is a fiction writer's dream. We love to fill in the gaps, right? That's where we stretch and where we grow and where we add in all this fun stuff. So yes, he ends up becoming kind of a major secondary character.
Yeah. Yeah. So how you talked about research. Mm-hmm. So do you research before you start writing, or do you start writing, figure out what it is you need to know, and then go do the research, or is it you're going back and forth all the time?
So it's a little bit of both. I do what I call front loading, where I spend a month to 6 weeks just doing as much reading as possible, looking at documentaries, looking at primary and secondary sources. Creating a historical outline that I arrange by topic actually. Topic and chronology. And then after I've gotten a good base about, you know, sort of the era and some of the topics I want to dig into, something happens, and it happens every single time. A title sort of forms in my mind, and I can see the opening scene. And as soon as that happens, I'm off and running. So I'll go ahead and start writing. And then as I hit speed bumps during the first draft, if it's a small thing like a type of skirt a woman would wear during this time period, I'll just put brackets and write skirt and fill that in the later drafts. But if it's a piece of information that I can't move forward without, like, you know, maybe something important about Scotland Yard that would be crucial to the plot, then I will actually pause and spend, you know, a couple of days, maybe a couple of weeks, depending on how much I need to know, researching whatever that topic is before I can start writing again. So, and I, you know, in a second draft, I double check some of my facts that I've been a little unsure about, or I think I need to make sure I really nail that. And then I fill in a bit more here and there too, as I'm fleshing things out. I tend to have a kind of a lean first draft. So my second draft, I end up adding 15 to 20K.
Oh, wow.
So you can see where I really flesh out more of those details.
Yeah. The internet must be a really important tool for you.
It is, but you know, I probably do more of my research through books, believe it or not. I gather a lot of texts that are used, you know, academic texts, that kind of stuff. You know, you find some really good, juicy information in there. And there's all those coffee table books that people are like, why do they even print these besides them being beautiful? You know, you find some good stuff in those. But yes, I absolutely, of course, use the internet. It's too helpful these days to not.
Yeah.
You can access any library anywhere if you go through, you know, your main branch.
Do you get books sent to you from far away?
Sometimes.
From the interlibrary loan?
Yeah, sometimes.
Yeah.
Wow. And then, of course, I try to go to the locations in person because there's just no substitute for that.
So that in this case, that would have been London.
That would have been London, yes.
What a tough thing to have to do.
What a hardship. It's one of my favorite parts, obviously, of the research. I mean, you know, I get to learn. And as a teacher, how could I not love that part? I love all the learning. I think that's one reason why I enjoy historical fiction so much, because I get to teach the reader something in a very fun, immersive kind of way, rather than, you know,
well,
in a sort of heavy hand,
yeah,
dry.
And yeah, story is the way that we learn best. So if you were trying to teach these same things in just a litany of facts, people wouldn't absorb it as well as they do in the story.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I can definitely see why you're drawn to it. Now, have you, as a French major, have you set any of your books in France?
I have. I have my first two books. Becoming Josephine was about Josephine Bonaparte, set during the French Revolution and then the Napoleonic era after that. And then my second novel was Rodin's Lover, and it's all about Rodin, the sculptor, and his lover and collaborator, brilliant artist, Camille Claudel, also set in Paris in the 1880s, which is one of my favorite time periods. That's when all art is thriving in Paris and the world's becoming industrialized. And I have a couple of others too. So,
wow.
So yeah.
So that,
France,
that means,
the landscape
for I was going to say, so that means you had to take trips to France as well, to Paris.
I did. And again, yeah. Such a hardship.
Yeah. Do you think about that when you're deciding what to write about? Like, is this some place I would want to go?
No, but you know, I should.
Yeah.
The book I'm working on right now is set in Washington, D.C., and I couldn't care less. I've already been to D.C. many times, and I don't love the energy of that city. It just, you know how when you go places, sometimes the energy can feel a little off. And I think it has a really interesting kind of energy that I don't connect with that well. There's some great things in DC, don't get me wrong. I mean, yeah. Some really wonderful museums, some great food, and a lot of other things. But location, but that's not a bad idea.
Now, the last time I was in London, which was just about a year and a half ago, we kind of accidentally, it wasn't planned, but we went to visit Parliament. We went in and watched a parliamentary session. It was like the first day or the last day or something, and they were arguing about the prime minister, and it was right before the one resigned or something. And it was so interesting to actually see that in person. And I don't think I would have ever really, you know, you see them yelling and stuff, but in shows sometimes, you know, but to actually watch the speech giving and while somebody else is snoozing off but they get very, very emotional. And it was really fascinating to see.
Yeah.
So
I can't imagine. Yeah.
When you decided to write Queens of London, tell us a little bit more about the 40 elephants and what they actually were historically and, where in London, you know, how they got their name, that sort of thing.
Okay. Yeah. So the 40 elephants can be traced back to the Victorian times. And the way they can be traced is basically through their arrest reports. a few headlines, but most of the headlines come, you know, in the 1920s or so and a little bit after. So you can trace them back to the Victorian times. They were called the 40 thieves originally. And they morphed into the 40 elephants probably because their sort of companion gang, the male gang, was named Elephant Castle Gang. And they were named after the neighborhood of London. So there, you know, there's a rumor that they were called the 40 elephants because these women would wear special pantaloons sewn with huge pockets and stuff their, you know, their loot in under their clothes. And then by the time they would leave the store, they'd be, you know, enormous, like an elephant. But that's a little absurd because can you imagine a shopkeeper not stopping a woman as she walks out looking like she's stuffed $500 worth of clothes under her her gown? You know, that just doesn't make sense. So I'm sure it was after the neighborhood.
Yeah.
And then over time.
Well, how did the neighborhood get that name? What an odd name.
Elephant Castle? Yeah. I actually have no idea. I know that there is a sign of an elephant with a castle on top of him. A very, very, very old sign. But I honestly don't know. I'd have to dig more into that. But it's been around for a long time, very long time. And it was kind of a crossroads. It actually still is a crossroads. If you go to that area now, it's big highways. But if, you know, back then it was a highway, but it, you know, it was dirt roads and then it was cobblestone roads and that kind of thing. So just a really different kind of feel from today.
Wow. Okay. So we have the 40 thieves and who was Annie Diamond? You know, what's her backstory?
So Diamond Annie's real name is Alice Diamond. Okay. And she was nicknamed Diamond Annie by the police because she wore diamond rings on all four fingers on both of her hands. And when she would get into a scuffle, she used them like a weapon. So this is how she got the nickname Diamond Annie. She began actually thieving at a really young age. Her father was a thief. Her mother was a thief. Her dad was actually known to be quite violent, even in society, not just in the household. In fact, I threaded a little fact into the story about how he scarred a mayor's face after he got into a fight with this man in the street. He was definitely known to be violent. So you can see where she comes from. She hasn't learned how to do an honest day's wage in her life ever. And, you know, they travel from one terrible hovel apartment to the next, skipping out on rent whenever possible. And when she decides to really embark upon this life of crime and she finds that she's quite good at it because she's very smart. She's very clever. She's great at reading people. So she starts to really elevate the gang. So they went from something that they, you know, people had heard of to a really powerful stronghold in the city that shoppers recognized on the streets, that the police knew because she was quite good at it. And she used her winnings to buy beautiful clothes, buy beautiful furs and diamonds and go to the fanciest clubs in Soho and drive, you know, the best roadster on the street. So she kind of elevated her living and her lifestyle by taking what didn't belong to her.
Now, in your book, she is also kind of a protector of other women. Is that historically accurate, do you think, or is that something that you imbued on her?
I think that at least to some degree it must be true, because you don't become head of the gang unless you look out for your flock. That's just how it is. And I think that, you know, we see a lot of movies and have read a lot of books about gangsters. But I think men operate a bit differently from women. There is a sort of unspoken code among women that when it's violated, you know, we get our hackles rise. We get real angry and, you know, but I don't think men have that same kind of, they do have a little bit of a loyalty code, but this goes beyond that. Mm. So part of it might be my own invention, but part of it I think is probably quite true. You just don't get to that kind of status, and have people come to you and want to be under your wing unless you do a good job taking care of your own. She actually collected a monthly stipend from the girls' winnings to pay for lawyers when they got in trouble.
Oh, so wow.
There were a lot of things that were put into place to protect, to, you know, the gang.
And was she unusually tall?
She was. She was 5'9". And back then, that was an absolute giant for a woman, and even tall for a man. I mean, I'm 5'9", and I'm taller than lots of men. So I could see where, you know, 100 years ago, with nutrition completely different, that was very, very tall.
Yeah, I wonder, you know, you can't imagine that her childhood nutrition was that great. So you wonder how she was able to get that tall.
Well, humans, we find a way to survive, don't we?
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. Now, Lillian, the Scotland Yard detective, you were actually able to find a lot of biographical information about her, correct?
I wouldn't say a lot, but a bit more. She did write a memoir.
Yeah.
And that helps, but it's not, you know, she didn't go much into her childhood or anything. It was really more about her time as a police officer and how she wanted to help, help women that were disadvantaged. But I did find a little bit more about her. In terms of the memoir, this great thing happened. I was actually looking for a copy. And you asked me if I sent away, you know, through interlibrary loan. There are about 20 copies or so left out there, most of them in the UK. But it just so happens that one copy is at UConn Library, which is in the town where I live. Talk about a sign. Yes, that's what I did. I said, you've got to be kidding me.
Wow.
So I went to the university there and got a library card and checked it out. And it turns out that they actually have a very large section about the history of the police, both male and female. And that's why they had a copy of the memoir. So that was very serendipitous.
Yeah, I'll say. Now, what was it that, you know, how did she become the first female inspector of Scotland Yard? What was her, in the book, it sounds like she had very supportive parents, but it takes more than that to take such an unusual career path.
Yeah, so she was a very bright person also, a bright student. She spent time as a nurse in World War I volunteering. So she had already, you know, been in a war zone, literally. Wow. And had seen, you know, a whole lot by the time she returned to London. And crime was rampant because of the, you know, so many men had died or men were not yet working. So she joined a voluntary female police squad that they got uniforms made, and they were more or less trying to help women especially, but just kind of keep crime down in the streets. And they kind of gravitated around the London parks, because there were makeshift World War I soldiers camps set up in these parks, which I did not know that. I found that fascinating. And women were being trafficked in these areas. So as is very often the case when you have war and you have military camps. So she volunteered for this force and then ultimately joined the Metropolitan Police when they began their own all-female unit. And the voluntary police, there was all this confusion about who's the real police, you know, and they ended up dissolving. And
because the voluntary police couldn't arrest anybody, could they?
And neither, you know what, they could not, and neither could the females that worked at the Met.
Oh.
For 7 years, they were members of Metropolitan Police Department and could not arrest.
Oh, wow.
They also had to leave the force if they got pregnant or married. Mm. So all these stipulations. So Lillian, of course, joined them, and she was a bit of a shining star because she was, you know, very fastidious. She had no interest, really, in having a family. That just wasn't her. That wasn't something that she wanted.
Oh, interesting.
So. Yeah. I didn't find any yearning about not, you know, falling in love. I didn't find any, you know, any of that about her at all. And then obviously that very well could have been true. I'm sure she had her moments when she was lonely, but she was incredibly busy and she worked really long, hard hours. I'm very, very proud of her work. So.
Okay. Well, Heather, why don't you read a little bit from Queens of London for us?
Okay. So I told Monica before we went on the air, but obviously this is going to be in an English accent and I'm not English. So I'm not going to force my terrible fake English accent on this. Just use your imagination. And we open here with chapter one, page one in Alice Diamond Annie's point of view. Alice wiped her knife clean. Specks of blood dotted the snow white handkerchief, even after what she thought had been a good washing the previous night. The man who'd met the end of her blade was strong, but she'd nicked him well enough that he'd turn heel and run, the tosser. Another street brawl, another lout who thought he could disrespect one of her girls, and she'd showed him a lesson, all right. She stowed her razor in the hidden pocket of her dress and headed to the kitchen for tea and a bite to start the day. Her mum was still in bed as usual, with her latest illness and weak lungs. Her brother loudly skulked around his bedroom, and her sisters were God knew where, but Dad was bent over his plate at the table. The only wretched member of the wretched Diamonds that Alice loved to hate and hated to love. Still, he was family. Family first, above all else. Alice had recited those words at her dad's insistence her whole life. If the family didn't rely on each other, they'd all be on the street, he'd say, as he collected the earnings they'd made from emptying pockets, clearing out shelves, and swindling the gullible. And they nearly had been on the streets year after year as he frittered away their income and landed himself in jail for picking fights with the wrong people. Despite it all, Alice had never questioned her dad's motto. The family's proclivity for crime meant they must stick together, like it or not, and mostly she didn't like it. She vastly preferred the family she'd made for herself, a certain group of friends, certain associates who followed orders and watched her back rather than beat it with their fists the way her dad had most of her life. Her girls were the 40 elephants, and she was their appointed queen, commander, woman in chief. Anyway, if they tried the malarkey that her dad got away with, she'd give them what for, and they knew it. "What's the mark?" her dad asked, drowning his breakfast tea in milk. His hair was slicked back with almond oil, and a spray of salt and pepper whiskers swept over his jawline. His eyes were red-rimmed from too much gin the night before. "You know I don't talk," Alice replied, taking a bite of buttered toast that had already started to go cold. She didn't share details with anyone but those involved in the scheme. It limited the chance for double-crossing. She brushed the crumbs from her wool dress and set her dish in the sink. "Watch it, girl," he replied. "You're getting a big head. That's when mistakes happen." She was glad the codger couldn't see her expression. These days, her jobs brought in far more quid than his did. More importantly, her jobs meant posh dance clubs, free-flowing gin and Irish whiskey, the fastest roadster on the streets, and beautiful clothes. For a short time, her winnings gave her freedom from the squalid life in which she was raised, elevated her above the muck and mire of London's darkest corners south of the Thames in the Elephant and Castle neighborhood. For every bolt of silk she cashed in, she transcended the grimy violence of her day-to-day and became someone different, someone with endless possibilities, at least until the money ran out, and the money always ran out. She wasn't the type who believed in saving just to take it to the grave. Her brother pushed past her much faster than most could on a peg leg. He'd lost his leg in the Great War, shot clean off. Served him right, some would say. He'd been a bully his whole life, and mostly good for nothing, stirring up trouble with the MacDonald brothers, the leaders of the Elephant Castle gang. At war, his time came due. Tommy had always looked after her, though, even if she was the eldest of eight, and he nearly 3 years younger. They'd been inseparable for a time. Was it much she wouldn't do for him, or him for her? Her brother placed a piece of bread in the turnover toaster, cranking the knob on the metal contraption that pushed the bread over a heating element until both sides were evenly cooked. When finished, he scraped a knife laden with butter across the surface and downed the nearly burned toast in a couple of bites. You going out? Nothing you need to concern yourself with, Alice replied, but I'll see you later at the pub. All right, then. All her brother needed to know right now was that she had a job. It was Friday, a day when the stores were swarmed with shoppers, and her girls' best day of the week to do their own shopping. Alice knew better than to hit a store in the early days of the week when the shop girls were bored and paired up with customers 2-1. Before she could leave, her dad grabbed her elbow. You've had some wins, but you're headed for trouble with that attitude, you hear me? He squeezed, his fingers digging into her flesh until she cried out. He may not be able to beat her senseless anymore. She was a grown woman, taller than most men, with large fists and a mind 3 times as quick. But he still had the ability to wound her. You underestimate me, she wrenched from his grasp. And people see through you. That's how you always get caught. He lunged for her, but she sidestepped his outstretched hand and headed for the door. Don't wait up, she called over her shoulder. She snatched a brawley on the way out in case of rain. He shouted expletives as Alice slammed the door behind her. A big head my ass, she thought. He didn't know the meaning of humility except to dish it out to others. He'd never shown her mercy, not even as a little girl. He hadn't shown it to any of them. She and her siblings had collected impressive bruises over the years to prove it. Even the Lord Mayor of London had permanent scars on his face after meeting with her combustible dad. Outside, the scent of rain lingered in the air, and a bank of clouds hung low and so thick that not a single shard of sunlight pierced them. Good thing she'd come prepared. She walked purposefully to her car, not losing pace as a rat scurried across her path before disappearing beneath a stack of abandoned crates. She'd grown up with them scampering through her flat, the nasty creatures. They were practically her siblings. She'd suffered their sharp teeth far too many times. Truth be told, she was lucky she still had all her fingers. She opened the door to her shiny black Chrysler and slid into the driver's seat. She smiled as the smell of new leather rushed her senses. Nothing beat the smell of money. She drove across the borough, parked her car in the street, and strode to a shuttered munitions factory. These days, the old factory served as a meeting place for the 40 elephants. It was quiet, abandoned, and not a place the coppers spent much time patrolling, though she and the girls had fended off squatters a little too often. Still, it was a decent location, despite the grit and grime that blanketed every nook and cranny. She wound through the musty dark, around broken machinery that had begun to rust from the perpetual damp air that seeped through the building's cracks and shattered windows. When she reached the back office, the 40 elephants were already gathering, seating themselves around the table. They were waiting for her, as they should be.
And that was Heather Webb reading from the Queen, or not the, just Queens of London. You know, one thing that really strikes me as I'm reading this book this is only 100 years ago, right? And how much things have changed for women, and especially for children.
Yes.
It's kind of appalling how little consideration a child was given in that world. You know, it's like people just looked the other way at the children living on the street or condemned them with and didn't really try and help them.
It's true. This is really where that phrase comes from. Children are to be seen and not heard. You know, it's a combination of, you know, the wealthy who made their children like little dolls, but made them keep quiet and out of sight as much as possible. You know, it's sort of an extension of that. The children just, they were definitely third class citizens, yeah. Barely citizens of that. I think honestly that we've gone a little too far in the other direction today.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. As a former high school teacher, I can tell you that a lot has changed, where, you know, kids are running the roost now, and it's that's not a good thing either. Yeah. There's got to be something between the two.
Absolutely. But it is hard to find that balance.
It is.
It really is. It is. So the fourth character that we haven't really talked about is Hera. Is that how you pronounce her name?
My orphan? Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yes. So tell us a little bit about her and why you added her into this story.
So Hera is, first of all, that means diamond in Hindi.
Ah.
And which, if you read the book, that makes sense. So I originally titled this Diamond Girls, and it was because Diamond Annie, you know, she refers to her pack as her girls. It got retitled. So Hera was she was a 10-year-old girl. Her parents are a British foot soldier and an Indian woman from Gujarat who's a silk weaver. And so she's technically from West India, and her parents die of cholera. She's shipped to the UK and is taken care of by her pretty cruel uncle, who's a bit of a crooked lawyer that keeps getting away with, you know, these crooked things, and has no interest in having this child in his house. And in fact, when her parents do die, he plans to send her to an orphanage in the north of England. Not an orphanage, but a boarding school that may as well be an orphanage. You know, kids are abandoned there all the time. So this is why she runs away. Now, it's funny that when I started writing this book, I heard her voice in my head before I heard any of the other characters' voices. I just knew that I wanted an innocent young girl who falls, you know, gets picked up by this gang on the street and take a close look at what that would mean and what that looks like and the choices she has to make and about who she wants to be and who she wants to become and who she wants to spend her time with. And I think it just adds a lot of dimension to the story to look at, you know, at her perspective. And in terms of the half Indian portion, so, you know, the English were well into their colonization at this point in the 1920s. And Indian culture was really starting to take hold in London, especially, but in the UK, as a whole. And so I wanted to look at that a little bit. India is the place I would love to go. It's like top of my bucket list. I love Indian food. I cook it. I've got a very good friend who is an Indian American author, Sonali Dev. She writes wonderful books, who I ended up talking to a lot about this. And she read the book too, just to, you know, make sure I was on the right track with some of the cultural elements. But so I was really interested in this aspect. And I thought, again, that it would give a little more context about the multicultural nature of London at that time.
Now, she faced a lot of discrimination for being Indian. Was it, you know, why would her parents have sent her to live with this horrible uncle instead of keeping her with them in India?
You know, that wasn't terribly uncommon. When there were babies born to British subjects in the Far East, and one, you know, I think we don't even use the term Far East anymore, but, you know, born in China or, you know, Hong Kong, any of the places where the British had a major presence, a lot of times the kids were sent home for schooling. They wanted to give them that proper English upbringing and have the proper schools and all that stuff, you know, the etiquette et cetera. So it wasn't an unusual thing. And at that time in India too, there had been a lot of sickness and there was just a lot of poverty. And so it made good sense to me that her father would have talked her mother, especially coming from a wealthy family, having talked her mother into, let's send her to England for schooling, and we will, as soon as my duty is up here, we'll move back too, and we'll be a family together. But then they get sick, they get cholera, they pass away. So.
Wow. Yeah, you feel so much sympathy for her, for Hira. And she doesn't really know much at all about her Indian heritage.
She doesn't.
And so I liked that in the book, when she runs away, she actually kind of stumbles upon a way to learn a little bit more about that.
Yeah, she's really kind of, there's this whole side to her identity that she doesn't really know well or understand, because her uncle has more or less, made it an off limits part of her upbringing. He doesn't like this part of her. So he, doesn't talk about it. She's never even seen someone with skin the same color as her. So.
Oh, poor kid. But, she survives and she ends up thriving in the, which is really nice. Yeah. Yeah.
You know what? I loved her so much as a character. She was very fun to write. She was precocious and brave, and, I did not plan on Biscuit, the sidekick. He just popped into the story, and I went, oh, she has a friend. All right. So she adopts this little mutt from the streets.
And he's very important.
He does. He becomes pretty important to the story, to her at the very least.
You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Heather Webb, author of Queens of London. So, what surprised you when you were researching this? Was there anything that really took you by surprise?
There's always a lot that takes me by surprise when I'm researching, especially when it's a topic I don't know that much about. I found it fascinating, the inner workings of the gang, really fascinating. And of course, that whole piece I talked about with the women being trafficked through the parks in London in World War One, it shocked me. I've written a book set during World War One that spans the 4 years, called Last Christmas in Paris, with Hazel Gaynor, with my co-author. And that wasn't a piece of information I had come across. So I found that really surprising. I'm trying to think what else. I mean, there was so much. I knew nothing about the female police at all. So I had a lot to learn there, too.
When would you say that... And maybe the answer to this is not yet, but that women were fully accepted as police officers in
I would
in
definitely
London.
Say not yet. I think, I have to say, when I see a female police officer, what comes to mind is I almost want to protect her. It's a strange thing. I feel like I see her and think, I hope they aren't horrible to her. This is what I think always crosses my mind. It's just like a female soldier. I think, in some ways women are at a disadvantage, whether we like it or not, in terms of strength. And of course, that's not always the case. There's
right.
Plenty of men who aren't particularly strong. But you know what I'm saying? On a very basic level.
On average, basically. On average.
Yeah. And, I just think about sexual assault. I always worry about that for female police and female soldiers. So I think there's a lot of stigmas that are still there. But I do think, sort of in the upper echelons, in the detective units, that women are getting a lot more kudos because opportunities because they're definitely as intelligent as a male in that role, and they think differently than a male would in that role, at least to some degree, and in a good way. So I think, I hope that there's been changes there for sure, but I definitely think there's still a lot of stigma that exists, and the struggle is real, as they say.
Yeah. So, Heather, I'm assuming that writing is your full-time occupation now. Well, writing and some teaching, but
yes, yeah. Writing and teaching. I'm a freelance editor. I think you mentioned that in my bio. Right. And yeah. I also do writing coaching for thenovelry.com, which is kind of an online school.
Oh, cool.
I'm writing and doing writing related things for sure.
And at what point in your writing journey did you say, okay, I'm not going to have, you know, a full-time day job. This is going to be my focus. And how did you know when you were, that it was time to do that?
So I'm one of those people who's lucky that has a husband that was working and I was pregnant with my second. So I resigned from teaching. My husband was a teacher though. It's not like we had, you know, money coming out of our ears, but my entire paycheck was going to go to pay for childcare or I could be home with the kids. So I ended up resigning. And being with the kids at home. And I started writing then. So it just sort of evolved from there. And, you know, I've had moments where it's a struggle and I've thought about, you know, going back and getting a full-time job again. It's, you know, publishing is not a meritocracy and it's not a linear process. So I think that's a really hard concept to understand until you've been in the business for a while. So, you know, there's always that thought, that possibility of going back and teaching full time, but I really like to keep doing what I'm doing, obviously. I love writing stories.
Well, it sounds work really hard at it, you know. But
I do.
Yeah.
I do.
And it's kind of frustrating.
I'm not a lazy writer, that's for sure.
That you can be a really good writer and write books that people really want to read, and it's still, you're not going to get rich unless you're one of the very lucky few.
Yeah. It's really, you know, it's one of those professions that is constantly portrayed incorrectly in all the movies. You know, the writer has a beach house in Long Island and, you know, things like that. When in fact, the vast majority are actually below the poverty line and not that many can make a living at it consistently. I've been lucky in that way. I say lucky. I work extremely hard to stay there. But
yeah. So how did you get your first book published?
So my first book, I met my agent at a conference and, you know, we got on really well and, I was lucky, you know, she was the right person at the right time. We were pitching, Josephine Bonaparte's life. It's called Becoming Josephine, at the right moment when biographical fiction wasn't saturated and people were excited to, you know, read more stories about real people. And it worked out. And Plume, who was an imprint of Penguin before it merged with Random House, bought my first two books. So
great. And now I've talked to authors who maybe, you know, were able to sell the first two books, but then still struggle with later ones.
Oh, sure.
Has that happened? Have you had that experience?
Yeah. Absolutely. that imprint was immediately non-viable from the moment they offered my contract because they were in the middle of a merger. So that imprint doesn't exist anymore. So my editor, of course, was laid off. All the writers that had been picked up for that time period, they did no marketing or anything for those books because they were, you know, that was going to be an obsolete imprint.
They were orphaned books, basically.
Right. And the only reason why they picked up books was just to fill their calendar until it closed. So after that, I basically had to fight my way through to keep getting contracts. And that means, you know, sometimes going at things sideways. I put together an anthology with a bunch of best-selling authors that did well. And then I ended up collaborating with Hazel and our books have done well. I wrote a solo novel that did not sell. I wrote another solo, about half of the novel. We went out with that didn't sell. So, you know, things happen like that and
what was the one that didn't sell? And why?
Oh, there's a million reasons why. The first one that didn't sell was called The Phantom's Apprentice, and it was a retelling of Phantom of the Opera from Christine Daae's point of view, sort of the real Christine Daae, the strong, she, you know, becomes herself kind of book rather than this sort of simpering weak Violet. We had a lot of interest in the book, but the marketing teams didn't know where to put it. They were all like, is this historical? Is this suspense? You know, it's a retelling. Those can be good and they can be bad. We're not sure. And I ended up not selling it. I self-published that book. That was the only book I've self-published. I wanted to learn about self-publishing. So I hired, you know, a cover designer. I hired editors to help me work on the book itself. And then I self-published it. And then the other story that didn't sell, I completely gutted the entire thing and just took the very basics of the pitch. And I actually just signed a contract for that idea. That's my work in progress right now. And that was back in 2016 or 2017 that I tried to sell that idea. And I just put it, you know, in a folder and started over with the concept. And here we are.
So do you know what will be next after that? Or do you have to wait till you get there and then it'll present itself?
Sometimes it's that. Sometimes it can be either way. Right now, because I've just had a lot going on, you know, I just launched Queens of London. I've got this book with Hazel due in March, and that's coming out later this fall. And then I have my other work in progress. So that's about all my brain can handle at the moment. But I have a contemporary idea that's all in my pocket, and I haven't written contemporary. So in terms of historicals, I've got a kind of a nebulous floating idea that's not really fully formed. I've got a few ideas, but we'll see what happens when it's time.
Have you ever had something that you thought you would write about, but when you got into it, you realized this isn't worth spending a year of my life on?
No. No.
Wow.
Actually, that's not true. When I very first began and I was working on becoming Josephine, I had this really intense dream. And so I stopped, and it was a YA novel. And I used to be a high school teacher, you know, so I had that young adult voice on my head. And I thought, oh, I think maybe this is the path I'm going to go on. And then I went on this tear and wrote about 100 pages very quickly of this YA novel. And then I just kind of went, I lost steam and realized, I don't know. And I put it in a folder. So that's the one time. And that was right when I first started writing. Luckily I haven't had that happen again, but it might.
Well, that's good. Yeah. Cause sometimes, you know, it can happen and you can get partway in and realize there isn't enough there.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I've had that when you're writing historical fiction, though, you kind of figure that out during the research process. I think, okay. So I have started researching a couple of different things and gone, this isn't going to make a full story. And I've stopped.
Okay. So that makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, Heather, we're out of time, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me. That was fun.
Queens of London was a really fun read, and I loved getting to know all the characters.
Thank you.
And we always end with a quote, so I'm pulling one from your website, because I'm guessing this is probably one of your favorite quotes, from Helen Keller. Life is a daring adventure or nothing.
I do love that one. And those are the kinds of books I write, so it's perfect.
That's right. And so thank you, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thanks.